Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Jim Milstein, and he has a fascinating history, not just in the world of corporate restructuring, but related to the financial crisis and the restructuring of AIG and a variety of other debacles he's had a front row seat to. If you are at all a student of how companies go bad and what we do with them afterwards, you're going to find this to be an absolutely fascinating conversation. He has a deep expertise in this space, starting out at Cleary Gottlieb, going to Lazard Frères, launching his own firm, Milstein & Company, which was recently purchased by Guggenheim Securities, and dead center in the middle of that, being the chief restructuring officer at the Treasury Department in the middle of the bailouts, 09, 10, 11. So I found this to be an absolutely intriguing conversation, and I suspect you will as well. With no further ado, my conversation with Jim Milstein. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is Jim Milstein. He is the co-chairman of Guggenheim Securities. He comes to us with a bachelor's from Princeton, a master's from Berkeley. He graduated with a degree in law from Columbia. Currently, he's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center. But perhaps most interesting for our purposes, he was the chief restructuring officer at Treasury from 2009 to 2011, responsible for oversight and management of Uncle Sam's largest financial sector rescues. Indeed, he was the principal architect of the restructuring of American International Group. Jim Milstein, welcome to Bloomberg.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So you have a fascinating background. You begin your career as a lawyer at Cleary Gottlieb. What did you imagine your career was going to look like when you first started as an attorney?
Well, like many attorneys, I kind of wandered into my first job without a real clear vision of what I was going to do. But, you know, Reagan had gotten elected. I had spent a couple of years out of Berkeley being a policy analyst and working on what was then called industrial policy, which was something that the United States probably implements only through the Defense Department.
Right.
But we had been part of a small group of scholars who were trying to urge the United States to deal with the then Japanese threat to our electronics and semiconductor and steel and automobile industries by actually coordinating tariff, trade, tax, and investment policy.
Sort of the way Trump is doing now.
Well, yeah.
Maybe not quite.
Not so coordinated.
Structured, but
yeah. And,
but the basic premise is we should be proactive here.
Yeah, well, you know, other countries are, right? We were dealing with a mercantilist nation in Japan, really Germany the same after World War II. Mm-hmm. China is obviously now engaged in the same kinds of behavior, but they've all learned from each other. You know, the Koreans learned from the Japanese, the Chinese learned from both of them, and they have a coordinated policy of credit, investment, tax, trade, in order to promote domestic employment and production. And, you know, the United States, we've taken a more free market, hands-off, laissez-faire approach, and you can see the consequences now as we find ourselves in a much more competitive environment. Anyway, long story short, spent a couple of years working on those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan gets elected. We're now in the, you know, Reagan, Thatcher, dismantle the welfare state. Industrial policy is probably never going to be on that agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So I determined instead of going back to Washington and working in the government, I'm going to work for a liberal international law firm, Cleary Gottlieb, that helped create the predecessor to the European Union after World War II. It was founded by a group of State Department officials in Paris and Washington simultaneously, and they helped create the Iron and Steel Union, which was the precursor of the EU.
So how do you transition from Cleary Gottlieb to Lazard Frères? That doesn't seem like a natural path.
Well, I had been working on Lazard and Cleary shared a client called Pan American Airways, which was the dominant international carrier in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Pan Am.
In the United States, Pan Am. And disappeared into the dustbin of history. But in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was the dominant international carrier for the United States. It fell on hard times as markets were deregulated and they found themselves subject to competition they really couldn't handle because they were a product of a regulated industry.
Right.
And they ultimately went bankrupt. Lazard and Cleary shared it. It was my first big debtor case as a lawyer. Running, in effect, an orderly liquidation of Pan Am, selling its routes off to United and to American and hither and yon. And at the end of the case, Felix Roten called me and said, "You're in the wrong business. You really should be a banker." And I resisted then. That was like 1992 or 1994. I resisted changing my career then. But in 1999, they came calling again. And after I was working on a large restructuring in Korea called Daewoo.
Mm-hmm.
They had borrowed
giant company.
Giant company. They again, one of the Korean kiretsu, their version. Trading company, a steel company, electronics company, a textile company.
Finance, real estate,
the whole nine yards. 10% of the Korean economy in one company under one roof.
What could go wrong with that?
What can go wrong with that? And they had borrowed $60 billion in all over God's green earth and, you know, fell on hard times as a result of the Thai baht crisis, which became the Korean won crisis in the late 90s. And so they hired Cleary, and I was in charge of that. And I hired Lazard to help me with it because they had restructuring and they had presence all over God's green earth where we had to restructure various debts. So I got to know the guys running that practice very well. At the end of it, they leaned over across the aisle from some god-awful flight from Tokyo to New York and said, "You know, you're in the wrong business." And I said, "I've heard this before."
From you guys, right?
Yeah. So this time I succumbed to the offer.
So you're there from 2000 to 2008 and we had a couple of little things happen in 08. How did you go from Lazard doing corporate restructuring to working with Uncle Sam, who was a little concerned about Lehman and AIG and everything else?
So I answered the phone is basically the answer to that. I had it's funny how the world works. I had a friend, a guy I had worked with when he was a young policy analyst in the Carter administration when I was
Whippersnapper lawyer?
When I was a graduate student out of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing things on industrial policy and he was reading them and helping promote them across the Carter administration. And anyway, I picked up, shortly after the election, like 10 minutes after the election of President Obama, then to be President Obama, I got a call from him and he said, "You might have noticed we're doing a couple of restructurings down here. The new administration could use someone with your background. Would you be willing to come?" And, I always had an interest in who would have believed that the country needed my expertise in particular. But there it was.
Quite fascinating.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you got a phone call. What made you decide to take what sounded like a pretty thankless role?
Well, that's what I do for a living, pretty thankless roles. But, I think I thought I might be able to make a modest contribution given mm-hmm. my background. And I had been, a student of the financial crisis as it was unfolding. We at Lazard, were running the leading restructuring practice. We had a lot of these, the front end of the subprime crisis running in, coming through our doors, American
mortgage companies,
mortgage
and others.
Originators and distributors coming mm-hmm. through. I mean, they were the first to fail, right? The front
sure.
end of the system was the first to fail, and that was in 07. I'm a curious fellow, and there was a plethora of these companies coming in. It was like, what's going on?
There was a website called mortgageimplode.com. Uh-huh. And it tracked, there's something like 400 of them blew up. But it would track it in real time and kept a running list. It was quite astonishing.
And some of the biggest ones, you know, New Century, American Home Mortgage, showed up at our doors as our clients. We, you know, presided over and helped them liquidate themselves, in effect. And so I, you know, my antenna went up. I got smart about the subprime crisis and the leveraging of the financial system and how they were levering themselves around these products and others. So when this call came, you know, having become a student of what had gone on in the American financial industry between 2000 and 2008, you know, my curiosity alone drove me to Washington.
So the news crosses, AIG gets $182 billion bailout. What's your immediate response when you see these are hard? We're kind of used to them today,
right.
But at the time, these numbers were just unfathomable.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I got there, AIG had already borrowed from the Fed in one pocket or another $132 billion. So that was in over the course of 8 weeks between September 18th, when the first loan was inked, to the time, you know, the transition team was in place and we were now trying to figure out what was going on. They had borrowed $132 billion, and that's when, you know, the restructuring first began, right? In most cases, with the exception of Lehman Brothers, what the federal government, the Fed, the Treasury, and the FDIC did during the course of 2008 was just refinance the balance sheets, the short-term debt coming due on the balance sheets of all of these companies.
Basically saying these companies are effectively solvent, but they have a very short-term liquidity issue, and if we could free that up, well, these are companies worth saving, and if they crash, it causes a big problem otherwise.
Well, an insolvency expert would say there are two definitions of insolvency. Mm-hmm. There's a balance sheet insolvency, where your liabilities exceed your fair market value of your assets, and then there's illiquidity, your inability to pay your debts when due. It was clear at the time that none of these companies could pay their debts when due. They needed, in effect, what the Fed was established to do, to be a lender of last resort, an emergency provider of liquidity when the markets freeze up and there are panics. And the Fed and the FDIC and the Treasury Department did this to a fare thee well during the Bush administration under the leadership of Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke at the Fed. So by the time we get there in, you know, late 08, we haven't yet assumed the powers, but there's a transition going on, a baton passing exercise going on between the Paulson Treasury Department and the Geithner Treasury Department.
And those guys had worked together previously, so it wasn't like they were strangers. Geithner was the president of the New York Fed.
Right.
So everybody kind of knew each
other.
Yeah,
no. There was a very seamless transition. And, you know, sometimes you get lucky as a country, right? We have the leading economic historian of the Great Depression sitting as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He may not have had a playbook as to what to do, but he knew what the Fed did wrong in the 30s, and he was dedicated not to doing that again.
Hey, learning what not to do is half the battle.
Exactly.
You put your way ahead of people. So you mentioned the difference between a liquidity event and a solvency event, and you mentioned in passing Lehman Brothers. Let's talk about that a second. There have been some academic studies that said at the time Lehman Brothers went belly up, their value was somewhere between a negative $100 billion and negative $200 billion. Of all the companies out there, they really seem to be completely insolvent.
Yeah.
Fair statement?
Well, so if you took a snapshot, I would venture to say, if you took a snapshot and mark to market the balance sheets of any of the major financial institutions, particularly the broker dealers, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, on September 1st, maybe make it September 9th, the day after Fannie and Freddie are taken into conservatorship and panic runs through the entire conventional and subprime. It had already run through the subprime market, but now you take the largest, you know, mortgage
conforming
players.
Mortgage,
right. So
a securitizer.
Right, exactly. And you put them in a conservatorship on the theory that either they're illiquid and need the government support, or they're insolvent and need the government's balance sheet to back them. If you took a snapshot of the balance sheets of any of the major financial institutions in the United States on September 9th and said, mark this all to market right now, where anything is trading, I dare say on a balance sheet basis, they'd all look insolvent. But that was sort of the thing. There's a relationship between your ability to maintain a position and your solvency. So, you know, Keynes famously said the markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. But if you can stay solvent, that is liquid, through a downturn,
you're okay.
And so
in fact, better. You come out the other side actually pretty good.
So in the case of Lehman, right? So you have Lehman weekend. You know, this story has been told many times, but the Fed, at the New York Fed, they're trying to figure out if they can broker a marriage between Lehman and Barclays or Lehman and Bank of America. And each of those institutions, the prospective buyers, is doing diligence as fast as they can on Lehman's book to try and figure out which part of the bank, if maybe the entire part of the bank, they will take. And in particular, B of A has done as good a job as could be done under the circumstances, an analysis of Lehman's real estate portfolio. And they conclude that the marks, that the last marks on the portfolio vastly overstate the value.
Fabricated.
Well, who knows whether it's fabricated? The market was going to collapse if you could have held on to it.
So
who knows?
So let me share my pet peeve.
Yeah.
Which is we'll hold aside the FASB rule change that no longer required mark to market. We'll discuss that later.
Right.
But the repo 105. If you have to, every quarter, a few days before you report your earnings, and you have to square up your quarterly numbers, you have to move $50+ billion of liability off your balance sheet.
Right.
That kind of implies that not only is your accounting not somewhat opaque, but it implies that you're committing accounting fraud on your investors, and you're probably either in bad shape or deeply insolvent. And we've since found that, forget the mark-to-market, they're deeply insolvent.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the conclusion the Fed reached. And they concluded that they really didn't have a statutory basis on which to be able to provide emergency lending to Lehman. You know, I think in retrospect, given the fallout that immediately occurred upon the filing of that bankruptcy, maybe we should have been more creative. We could have foisted losses on the shareholders. We could have foisted the losses.
Well, we did.
Right. Well, we had a bankruptcy. You know, we could have achieved the kind of, you know, anti-moral hazard problem with bailouts, potentially in the way we structured a loan to the broker-dealer so as to avoid the kind of adverse impacts that, I mean, that the filing of Lehman Brothers created a panic.
Well, okay. I'm not going to disagree with that.
Right. And so, you know, the whole script of the rescue from, you know, the beginning of with Bear Stearns to the opening of the FX lines to make sure that the European banks didn't default against on their own debt and therefore default on their American counterparties, which would have created a liquidity crisis here, to the, you know, putting of Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship, the saving of AIG, the series of the alphabet soup of emergency lending programs the Fed instituted, the prime dealer credit facility, the TALF, the TAF, the, you know, commercial paper facility. I mean, you know, there was every market that had frozen up, they intervened in and tried to restart in order to provide liquidity to the system. And so the question is, you know, in the midst of that just tsunami of credit support and liquidity, you decide to take one company down.
My pet thesis is Dick Fuld said no to Warren Buffett's offer to inject capital over the summer. And I wish I was a fly on the wall in that room, because I have to imagine between Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner, someone said, this idiot said no to Warren Buffett. How can we possibly save him? They had an opportunity. He was a pig. He's always been a pig, and now he should be in an orange jumpsuit. But
we're not automatons.
Okay.
And personalities and personal histories matter. And I don't think I don't think you're crazy in that thought.
So let's talk a little about what's going on currently in your career. After you leave Treasury, you go to work as a banker and an investor, and you pretty much decide to hang out your own shingle, Milstein & Company. Tell us about the launch of that firm and what the thinking was, as opposed to being attached to another giant financial entity.
Yeah, I mean, one thing working in the government cures you of is the desire to have a boss.
Right.
So I decided I would set up my own shop. I really had no, you know, grand plans, but we went from, you know, one answering another call to another call to another call, and before I knew it, You know, I had offices in New York and Washington, and we were working on large corporate restructurings and sovereign restructurings again. And also, you know, reinvesting the profits of the business, the partners, the guys who joined me and guys and gals who joined me. You know, we all agreed that the advisory business is a business that goes up and down, and mm-hmm. revenue is volatile, whereas if we could actually make some solid investments, we might be able to provide ourselves with a little more secure income in a manner and to generate wealth, particularly for the young kids who were working mm-hmm. for me. So anyway, 7 years into this, we ended up with 35 people doing corporate and sovereign restructuring and, you know, 15 people doing investing. Mm-hmm. And we had raised some third-party funds. And, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I'm 63 years old, and the people who had joined me were all in their 30s and 40s. And, you know, I turned to them and said, we have a strategic problem. Two strategic problems. One, we're a small boutique entering what I think will be a tsunami of restructuring to come. Mm-hmm. And we really could use the leverage of a larger firm with, you know, arms and legs in various industries with real industry expertise, as opposed to our sort of product specialty called restructuring. On the one hand, and the other strategic challenge was, you know, we've built a franchise and I'm not getting any younger. So eventually we concluded that merging with a larger financial services firm made sense. Alan Schwartz and I had been talking for 3 or 4 years.
Former Bear Stearns CEO, is that right?
Former Bear Stearns CEO, and really one of the most widely respected bankers, investment bankers in the United States. I mean, he's, you know, Disney's banker, Verizon's banker. He's a very well-respected boardroom banker and tactician and strategist. So, and he and I had become friends after the crisis. And so it was a natural fit. They have, you know, 400 bankers who do, you know, tech, media, telecom, power and energy, real estate, and the whole landscape, waterfront, as well as sales and trading. So they're kind of, you know, what Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs were back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. They've built an independent investment bank.
But before they went public.
Before they went public and expanded their balance sheets enormously.
Tremendously. Right. So you mentioned something in passing I can't let go by. You think we're at the leading edge of a wave of future restructurings. Is that global? Is that industry specific? Where do you see that happening?
Well, let's do some stats. You know, corporate debt to GDP is the highest it's been in American history ever. Mm-hmm. So we have a very levered corporate sector. And part of that is, you know, the financial reengineering of their own balance sheets, stock buybacks funded with debt. Part of that is, you know, the buyout waves and leveraging generally that's associated with the buyouts. And part of that is, you know, just the general trend to the credit has been so cheap that that corporations have re-engineered their own flows.
That was the question I immediately popped into my mind after you said that was, well, is there a reason for them not to be leveraged up when money is almost not quite free? And as long as they're, I hope everyone learned the lesson about fixed versus variable lending in the financial crisis, as long as those rates are locked in, it seems like their debt servicing is fairly affordable.
It is.
Until profits go away.
There are two sides of that, right? And, you know, if your cash flows decline because of a recession, suddenly your leverage goes from manageable to unmanageable. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a rising interest rate environment, forget about floating rate. You know, a lot of bank debt is floating rate, but that's at a leverage level that is generally 2 to 3 times, so it's not going to sink a company even in a declining cash flow environment. But the real risk is refinancing risk, which is exactly what we saw during the financial crisis with the financial institutions.
In other words, they have to roll that debt over, and it's at a much higher rate, or maybe they can't roll it over at all.
Exactly. So with a very highly levered corporate sector, and if you look at credit quality, Barry, I mean, I'm sure you know these stats, you know, 50% of the so-called investment-grade debt
is the
lowest investment grade ranking, and the non-investment grade debt now constitutes more than half of all debt on the corporate sector in the United States. So you have a highly levered sector with very low credit quality. You know, we could, and you have a Fed raising interest rates, the federal government borrowing like a drunken sailor. on leave.
I always object to that metaphor because drunken sailors spend their own money.
Money, exactly. Okay, you're right. The federal government borrowing like there was no tomorrow. How about that?
Fair enough.
Right.
You've had a ringside seat to some of the most fascinating restructurings of recent memory. You either worked on these or near these, or people in the firm did some work on them. U.S. Airways, Charter Communications, the auto workers, the car makers bailout and reboot, even countries like Cyprus and Greece, and in the United States, Puerto Rico. So I have to ask you, what do all these things have in common, and what are the important differences when you look at these big financial snafus? What should we make of these?
Yeah, so Tolstoy in Anna Karenina says that all happy families are alike, and each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Mm-hmm. And each restructuring, you know, is unique in its own way. There's sometimes it's management that just, you know, went off on a frolicking detour, spent too much money, levered up, and on a mistaken strategy. Other times it's, you know, a change in the business cycle. And a highly levered balance sheet that takes a perfectly good company that in ordinary times is generating, even in bad times, is generating cash flow, but it's just got the wrong balance sheet for the kinds of cash flows capable of generating through a cycle. And so you're doing a balance sheet restructuring of a good business. You know, and other times it's a business that, you know, whose time has come, whose mission has long since passed.
Hypothetically, a company like Sears.
Exactly. And so,
or not so hypothetically, by
yeah.
The time
so
the
real world,
this.
Apparently, yeah. You know, in the case of countries, it's some combination of investor enthusiasm, misplaced enthusiasm for mm-hmm. sovereign debt, and a failure to really look at the underlying dynamics of a country's economy.
I was just in Iceland, and the story there is just—it's crazy,
right?
It's
crazy again.
Right. It's an island of, you know, the size of
people.
Boston, right?
Right?
And they were levered like 8 to 1 against GDP is
yeah.
just nuts.
Well, they were a product of, you know, open capital, no capital controls and capital, you know, swashing through the system.
So how is that different from Greece or Puerto Rico?
Well, so Puerto Rico, the capital markets were open, mm-hmm. and as long as they were open, you could do deficit financing.
Right. Even though states and cities are not supposed to do deficit financing.
That's right. But you know, municipal bankers, of which I do not count myself as one, have found lots of ways to
get around those rules.
Well, to find ways to finance deficits that are not completely transparent. And so Puerto Rico went into a recession in 2006 as a result of change in federal law that had formerly subsidized pharmaceutical production on the island.
Mm-hmm.
They had a 20-year tax break that encouraged pharmaceuticals to do their final packaging on the island and created 350,000 jobs and
wow.
lots of tax revenues. And that expired in 2006. Puerto Rico went into a recession that they still have not come out of. You know, 12,
a decade plus later.
Yeah,
wow.
A decade plus later. And they financed the decline in tax revenues with debt.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of it. So they, by the time they got to us, Milstein and Company then, in 2014, they had $75 billion of debt for an island of 3.5 million people. They had pension systems that were underfunded to the tune of $30 or $40 billion. And a real inability to pay their debts when due, and particularly as the capital markets shut to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, as long as you can roll that debt over,
doesn't matter.
But if you can't roll it over because, you know, suddenly you're borrowing the debt you had incurred at 2% in the muni market, you're now having to pay 8% tax free. You know, it just makes it unsustainable.
Right. I was in Puerto Rico. I want to say 14 or 15. And already there was a brain drain going on. There were people forget it's not a different country.
Right.
You could hop on an American Airlines flight and go anywhere in the United States, no passport required.
Right. And lots of people did and have. And so in any event, so, you know, countries are much more complex. And you know, we're seeing, frankly, we're doing a lot of work now in the United States because you have a series of states that don't look all that much better than Puerto Rico did in 2014.
Illinois has to be a giant mess.
Illinois, Connecticut. I mean, all of the...
How did Connecticut go south so fast? I mean, at one point, they were one of the wealthier states in the country.
Well, they're still one of the wealthier states in the country. The problem is that their economy is growing slower than the rest of the surrounding states, and they've levered themselves up and deferred pension contributions for 20 years. And as a
what
result,
could go wrong with that?
Right. I mean, you know, this is the responsible handling of the commitments you make as a state is critical to the stability of the state.
So if you're a fill-in-the-blank teacher, police officer, fireman in any of these states, are you going to get 100 cents on the dollar of your expected pension retirement, or everything's on the table in order to make these states solvent again?
You know, it seems unlikely.
Really?
There's a $3.5 trillion deficiency in the funding of state employee pensions nationwide. $3.5 trillion.
Amazing.
And the problem for these public employees is that at least today, even in Trump's America, there are no walls built between the boundaries of different states. So if a state starts overtaxing compared to other states, its citizens, and underserving them in terms of the provision of current services in the form of good infrastructure, good schools.
People leave.
And when they leave...
Look at Kansas. Look what a mess they made over there.
When they leave, they take their tax revenues and property taxes and income taxes with them, and it becomes an adverse feedback loop. Mm-hmm. A fewer and fewer number of citizens are supporting a greater and growing liability for legacy costs. And so, you know, this is... There's going to have to be a reckoning here.
That's the name of your next book, The Reckoning.
The Reckoning, yes.
I like that. So let's talk about something that's a little more cheerful. I know you are a fan of watching the financial sector and looking at some of the dominant players, which have become very concentrated post-crisis. And I know you're a fan of fintech. When you look at this... Are these big companies going to stay entrenched and keep putting up walls to prevent competition, or can the new financial technologies, can these new upstart companies break that hegemony from the big finance companies?
The answer to that is it's going to depend on government policy.
Really?
Because what is going on with the financials and fintech is similar to what's going on with Facebook and Snapchat and Google and every other, you know, high-flying startup technology company.
Now, why aren't those tech companies just thought of as aggressively competing in the marketplace? And you have Apple and you have Amazon, you have Google, you have Facebook, you have all these companies.
Yep.
Granted, there are four giant winners, but still you could look at how many search engines were there before Google became dominant.
Right. But these companies are rolling up, you know, potential threats to their competition. And it's a great exit for a venture capitalist and for an entrepreneur who has a great idea to sell yourself to Google, to Amazon, to Apple, to Facebook. And the big banks are doing the same thing in fintech. There have been a multitude of startups in and around the financial services space. And the big banks recognize the potential threat. So they're doing a lot of in-house R&D, but they're also acquiring a lot of the new startups. And so government policy will really make a difference. And here's the thought experiment that I urge you and your listeners to think about. So today, we have a bank-centric deposit system, right? If you want to store your money, have immediate access to your cash liquidity, right? If a trade-off from liquidity versus return, you're going to have a deposit account at a bank to meet your ordinary and immediate spending needs. It's safe because it's guaranteed by the federal government. The banks, in turn, take your deposits and deposit them their excess reserves at the Fed, and the Fed is now paying them 75 basis points for the privilege of having those excess reserves on deposit at the Fed. The Fed is basically a clearinghouse among all the banks. Well, what if you, Barry Ritholtz, could have a deposit account at the Fed? you could get 75 basis points. And you could direct the Fed to transfer your money to your mutual fund, to your utility bill, to your wherever you wanted it to go. In other words, what if you had a bank account at the Fed?
If I could become a systemically important financial institution, I know they'll be able to bail me out when
yeah,
I run into
but,
trouble.
Well, maybe that wouldn't come with your deposit account.
Oh, okay.
But the facility with which monetary policy could then be conducted is extraordinary, right? Because mm-hmm. If they want to encourage savings and reduce the money supply, they would increase the interest rate on your deposit account. If they want to encourage investment and spending, they would reduce the interest rate, maybe even have a negative interest rate to force your money out. But the point is that it would disintermediate the banks. And banks arguably would have to go find other sources of funding other than subsidized deposits from the federal government.
And you're implying fintech is going to play this role, can play this role.
Yeah, I don't know where you are on the cryptocurrency debate.
I'm a full-blown meh.
Yeah. As opposed to Nuriel, who is, a full-time...
He's a little late to that, but still.
Okay, but in effect, the Fed could issue a digital currency. You have a trusted agent issuing a digital currency that allows individuals to, in effect, transact in electronic form as opposed to just allowing...
Via the blockchain? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, they might implement it via blockchain. But right now, the implementation itself is quite expensive in blockchain. The processing costs far exceed what the antiquated networks of Visa and MasterCard, their processing costs. But it may get there.
Now, people, something like 20% of all cryptocurrencies have been lost. And if I lose my credit card, my liability is capped at $50. So... Right. Until we find a way around that.
Yeah, no, I think there are lots of problems with this. But the biggest problem with any currency, a fiat currency, is whether it's legal tender. And so, until it's accepted as a form of payment by the federal government, it's really just a speculative tool.
Quite fascinating. Can you stick around a little bit? I have a million more questions for you.
Sure.
We've been speaking with Jim Milstein. He is the co-chairman of Guggenheim Securities. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and come back for the podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue discussing all things restructuring. You can find that at iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Bloomberg.com, wherever your finer podcasts are sold. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at MIBpodcast@Bloomberg.net. You can check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com/opinion or follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the podcast. Jim, thank you so much for doing this. I am not only fascinated by the entire financial crisis over... That was my doctoral thesis.
Right.
But there's so much minutia in that space that I think so many people don't know. And you were literally table right there. You had a seat at the table... Right in the middle of that.
In the belly of the beast.
And never any interest in writing a book going... For posterity's sake, there should be a full data dump on everything you... We have
what
Geithners,
I learned
we
when
have
I went
Bernanke's,
to Washington, right.
But not from the perspective of the central banker. I'm glad Bernanke had his expertise, although, whenever they screw up in surgery... and they have to send someone in to fix it, it's never the original surgeon because he has a vested interest in protecting his own reputation. Right. My thought process was, hey, Larry Summers was there, you know, was the guy who repealed Glass-Steagall and passed the Commodities Future Modernization Act. Tim Geithner was the New York Federal Reserve president, and Bernanke was kind of there cheering Greenspan along to doing all of his, talk about a reputation collapse, but all of his ideology, Bernanke was right there with him. So I wonder if this really was the optimal, maybe that's the right word, the optimal crew to go in and rescue. That said, I completely appreciate Bernanke having had his expertise, and perhaps of all of them, he was the right guy in the right time.
Yeah. Well, Tim had his own qualifications, right? He had lived through, I mean, people thought he had worked at Goldman Sachs or something. He'd been a long-term Treasury Department official
at
New York Fed, and he had gone through the Thai Baht crisis. He had seen the crisis in Latin America in the 80s when he was a young man. So, you know, I think he came to the crisis, this crisis, with some background and experience and understood the tools and the importance of doing what we did. So, all that said, you know, when I got out of the government, having been a corporate restructuring guy rather than a financial regulation, financial industry banker, you know, I determined that I needed to go teach a course on financial regulation and the crisis in order to figure out what I had just gone through.
Right.
And, you know,
you write in order to figure out what you think. In your case, you teach in order to figure out.
Exactly.
So I and you're still doing that at Georgetown.
Yeah. I just finished the third semester of teaching on that with Tim Massett, who ran the CFTC under the last Obama administration. And he had also been at Treasury with us in the TARP program. And so he and I taught that together, which was, you know, it was fun to do it with him my third time around. But I think it's still too fresh, you know,
really?
From the point of view
it's
of writing a book.
Old.
Yeah, but I think it's still too fresh. I mean, you have a lot of kind of, you know, from the front line accounts that have already been written.
And those were written pretty much in real time. They came out within a year or two.
Exactly. And then, you know, Secretary Geithner wrote his book, and Bernanke wrote his book, and Paulson's written his book, and there have been a couple of, you know, lieutenants and sergeants who've written their books. But I think...
Plus random idiots who had nothing whatsoever to do with it came out and spilled their point. Wasted.
I'm actually in the middle of reading Tooze's book, which I think is Adam Tooze. It's called Crashed. It just came out.
Yeah.
It's very good because it takes a... It situates the crisis in the kind of macroeconomic environment of the early 2000s, of the early aughts. And, you know, if you've just cast, you know, the thing about the crisis is it kind of overwhelmed everything else that we might have been thinking and using as a frame of reference. It overwhelmed, you know, the introduction of the iPhone, which has had at least as important an impact on our culture and society as the crash itself had in 2008. You know, the iPhone introduced in 2007. But, you know, what Tooze highlights is, and it's relevant today to the existing problems with China, is, you know, we had a savings glut that we were all worried about, that we thought that, you know,
I've always hated that argument.
I know.
But terrible.
But it's true. Having run deficits and trade deficits, run deficits since the Clinton administration and run trade deficits since the 60s, you know, we've been exporting dollars around the globe for 40 years. At the same time that we're deregulating the financial system, and the largest holder of dollars were, you know, there were two pools, huge pools of dollars offshore.
China,
one
Japan.
In Europe. Yeah, China, Japan, and in Europe, right? And that savings glut was the concern of the Fed and of all the macro.
Bernanke wrote a white paper on that.
Exactly.
I thought it was just a horrific, just completely clueless argument from people who were, it's a classic example. I have a lot of respect for academic research and writing, but often when you get into the real world situations, sometimes the academics take an idea and they go off. So what's more significant, the savings glut or rates at zero and bond managers scrambling for any sort of yield and telling their existing traders and managers, go find me some yield, and if you can, I'll fire you and find someone who can. What's this alt-A and subprime securitized stuff that is safe as treasuries and paying a few hundred basis points higher. Why don't we have more of that?
Yeah.
That's a real world thing that the academics have a tendency to miss.
For sure.
Until after the fact.
Yeah, but you know, but they're in defense of some academics. My friends Gary Gordon and Andrew Metrick at Yale have done, you know, great writing about the confluence of events that led to the great innovation of a subprime mortgage, of a, you know, 2-year teaser interest
228,
rate. Yeah, the 228 or the 327.
I could have saved them a lot of paper and said, you have no real wage gains for 30 years. And people looking to do to maintain their living standard, even though their incomes are much lower. So that means debt and restructuring.
So here's another book, an obscure book that you might want to read, called "Capitalizing on Crisis." It's written by Grippner, I think is her name, Greta Grippner, and it's all about the political origins of modern American finance. And the story she tells, which I think is, you and I lived through, I think you're a little younger than me, but not much.
You got about 5-6 years.
Yeah. Was that, you know, the stagflation of the 1970s created a political crisis. Because
with lasting impact that people were unaware of.
And the one of the biggest policy initiatives of the Reagan administration and every administration since has been to expand the provision of credit, where incomes were lagging and failing and falling behind, we substituted credit.
No doubt about that.
Widespread credit availability and, you know, levered up both the government to do so, levered up households in order to turn their homes into cash machines to supplement, so they could supplement their incomes with the increase in the value of their homes. To finance the purchase of everything under the sun from every consumer durable available through credit cards and installment credit.
A lot of that goes back to post-World War II, 50s and 60s.
It does.
But really the 70s is what flipped that when suddenly giant inflation, that was the beginning of no real wage gains. And then the whole Reagan era forward, it was clear that capital had a better seat at the government policy table than labor did. And 30, 40 years later, we've seen, what are we now, the percentage of corporate profits as a percentage of GDP is at its all-time high, which means that labor is getting less.
Right.
I pretend to be a free market capitalist, but I can't help but look at those numbers and say, hey, this is problematic. We keep this up and we're going to elect some crazy populist as president.
Yeah,
and then what?
Okay, and then what? And so here's another book for your listeners. It's called Can Capitalism Be Saved? By my good friend Steve Perlstein, who's the chief economics writer of the Washington Post. And he's written a really thoughtful book about, is greed good? No. Is fairness going to make us poor? No. You know, it's a very serious treatment of the questions that we're now confronting as a nation with the highest inequality in American history.
So does he conclude capitalism can be saved? Or?
Yeah, capitalism can be saved, but what this has been true, you know, really since the progressive era. You know, this is a joint venture between government and capital to come up with a society that is productive and just.
So I have a, this will be my last pet thesis. Europe began as a feudal system where the king owned everything and you were allowed to work on the land. And if he threw you a little bit of wheat and some food to survive, that was up from zero. And the reason Europeans are so much more comfortable with some aspect of socialism with their capitalism is they started out with zero. And as they went higher and higher, to them, oh, wait, we get to own land, we get to have, well, since the government used to provide everything, food, protection, what have you, having the government pay for healthcare and retirement and education seems to make sense. The U.S., on the other hand, started with the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Government did nothing and you were responsible for 100% of your own safety. So one starting from zero and going up and the other starting from 100 and going down. And there's resistance in both directions, but
well, the myths by which we live, right? I mean, you and I, our immediate parents, their grandparents, you have to go probably back four generations before you have someone homesteading.
Right.
And, you know, protecting themselves and fending for themselves. And yet this myth of the American frontier is very powerful in our political ideology and therefore in our social policy. But the reality, you know, four generations later from the last homestead or the last frontiers woman and man, is a multi-ethnic, multi-racial society. You know, we have one of the greatest challenges, I think, in human history, which is, can we create a tribe, one tribe out of many, you know, e pluribus unum. And it really is, it befalls to us as Americans to figure out whether we can make this a democracy out of, you know, many tribes.
I think we need to do a better job of educating our students, not just teaching them to attest as middle school and high school students, but having them have a better understanding of all these forces and teaching them how to think as opposed to teaching them to memorize, because we've created several generations of people. So you and I both have an advantage of a legal education, which to me the most important thing law school teaches you is not case law, is not specific, but the entire process of here's the basic syllogism, here, so you don't know what the law is going to look like in the future. You don't know what sort of random fact pattern you're going to encounter. How can you, regardless of circumstances, apply some specific fact pattern to whatever the case law happens to be at that moment? You have to learn how to think. It's very flexible and it's very open-minded. And I don't know of a lot of other industries that teach that. And
I agree with you. I think the legal education, I think it goes on maybe a year too long.
Yes, for sure.
But I think the training is unsurpassed.
It's not what to think, but how to think.
How to think.
And I make fun of my MBA buddies who are taught what to think.
Right.
Or they're taught the canon of financial literacy, but not necessarily, and now here's how to analyze when either this stops working or this goes wrong, or, and it's a, I don't want to make this a JD versus an MBA, but they're two very different philosophical approaches. And in the modern world where everything is topsy-turvy, I have come to the conclusion that learning how to think is a tremendous skill to have.
Yeah, but I also think I agree with that, and surely our schools can do a better job of developing that, you know, emotional intelligence and analytic ability, to, the ability to handle new facts and put them in, find new patterns. But I also think that the social media has in a funny way, has isolated people from one another. It's isolating communities as much as it's creating cross-community, the possibility of cross-community communication. And so I've come around to the view that we really need national service, that in order to...
Works in Israel.
Yeah, it works in Israel for, and it made sense.
And Switzerland, for
that matter. Jews from all over the world, different ethnic and national backgrounds into one little desert country. And it was a way of forging a national identity. And I think we have that problem in the United States now. We really, we've separating into separate tribes, and not just Democrat and Republican, but, you know, the identity politics.
Urban versus farmer.
Right, exactly.
And men versus
all
women,
of the identities.
There's a million splits.
And I think, you know, I think 2 or 3 years of mandatory national service is the best hope for the future of this country.
I have a buddy who's an American citizen at UBS, but he grew up in Switzerland, and I don't know if they're still doing this, but not all that long ago, every citizen and every resident was obligated to serve at least 1 year in the military or some other public service.
Right. It doesn't have to be
service.
The military here.
Right.
I mean, I think there's lots of need in America that could be met by a national corps. And I think having, you know, the experience before you go to college of actually having to live and work with people different to yourself, but all of whom are American, would be a great national unifier.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. In 2011, I found this interesting quote of yours. The need for a chief restructuring officer is really part of the past. So how did you realize, hey, my work here is done, it's time to move on? And the Lone Ranger goes off into the sunset. How what made you come to that conclusion?
Well, I think the macroeconomic conditions surely had eased. So the Fed had embarked on its quantitative easing. The markets had rallied. You know, the depth of the market, the equity market and the credit market were in May of 2009. By the time you got to the end of 2010, you had seen a rally back. The rallies had both started in both markets. And most importantly, by the end of 2009, the interbank lending market opened up again. The banks were actually comfortable enough with each other to start lending to each other overnight. And and that was a pretty real sign of that the crisis had passed. But, you know, I was part of the cleanup crew, and part of my job was to get the taxpayers' money back. You know, by the time 2010 had ended, we had struck a deal with AIG's board for a complete recapitalization of the company. We had converted some debt into TARP equity, some Fed debt into TARP equity along the way in 2009. And then we did a series of asset sales and restructurings from AIG. We reduced its balance sheet from $1 trillion of assets to $500 trillion of assets, selling off its Asian life insurance operations, its Middle East life insurance operations, its Middle European life insurance operations, and 100 other businesses along the way that they were involved in.
So what does AIG look like today?
So AIG today is still one of the largest property casualty insurers in the world. It's one of the largest domestic life insurance companies. Not a lot else. We sold off the aircraft leasing business, the consumer finance business, as I said, all these other worldwide life insurance operations.
So they had a ton of assets that were very savable.
They were very savable. And as a result of the asset sales, we managed to use the asset sales to pay off the Fed's loans, leaving the federal government with, you know, $50 billion of preferred stock. We converted the preferred stock into 92% of the common stock. And so we now had a liquid market, and eventually we had a liquid market into which to offload the Treasury's shares of common stock.
So that brings up another peeve of mine. I think that process where the rescuer gets most of the equity is a reasonable one. Hey, we're taking all the risk. We're putting up all this money. Maybe this works out. Maybe it doesn't. And so there's a big upside at the end of it. Not that the government is doing this for the trade.
Right.
They want to prevent the next Great Depression, but it seems fair. We didn't seem to do that with anybody else. We rescued Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Citi for, I don't know, the 14th time Citi has been bailed out. I think it's three or four over the past century. They have a long history of that. Go down the list of other companies that needed bailing out and were rescued and were illiquid, but their balance sheet was transparent. You know, the one lesson everybody forgets from Lehman Brothers is if you're going to have an opaque balance sheet that's, forget the insolvency, just the inability for anyone to figure out what the hell is going on there, if you need a rescue, you're in trouble. And
right.
And that's a big part of that. So why didn't we take a similar approach to AIG where effectively, Uncle Sam was the debtor-in-possession financer, and when that worked out, they captured whatever upside there was to be captured.
Yeah, so I think the structure of the TARP program, which was where we ultimately determined to infuse preferred stock equity into the balance sheets of all the major financial institutions, I think there could be some serious criticism of the way it was done, I think it may have created more of a political backlash
for sure
against the program than
the
it needed to.
The Tea Party and everything else.
Well, I mean, the origins of the Tea Party are something we could debate for a while, but no doubt the crisis had something to do with it. But I think the one criticism I would have of the initial TARP program was that the as long as the preferred stock was outstanding, the company should not have been permitted to pay the kinds of bonuses that they paid.
Right.
right? I mean, as long as you're beholden to the federal government for equity on your balance sheet, you shouldn't be paying bonuses.
Didn't the Fed have to sign off on bonuses?
Eventually, they didn't sign off on the 2009 bonuses, 2008 bonuses. And I think that was the one, those were the bonuses that provoked the enormous political.
Sure.
Because most
ordinary
Americans.
Should have been clawing back bonuses, not paying them.
Yeah, and I think most Americans were kind of, you know, right in the view of like, wait a second, you're paying yourself billions of dollars of bonuses with taxpayer money?
Right.
I mean, really?
For bankrupting the company. Nice,
right.
Nice work. Here's a bonus.
Now, the counter, you know, what Secretary Paulson would say, who designed this preferred, is it was important that everyone participate. All the major institutions participate, because we couldn't permit the negative inference that if Jamie Dimon held out, that he was the only solvent bank in America.
Right.
And so they had to make the terms of the preferred as relatively benign and painless as possible in order to induce widespread participation by all of the institutions, so there could be no picking and choosing of winners and losers. And
so here's where I make fun of academics again. And you don't want to be too heavy-handed, but you could have had a less egregious setup. And if Jamie Dimon doesn't want to participate, well, then Bernanke has to say to him, full New Jersey, bent nose accent, hey, nice bank you got there. Shame if anything were to happen to it.
Right.
How much more do you have to say, listen, this is a disaster. We're about to have the Great Depression. Either you participate in this, or I have a feeling that the next time you come to the normal transaction process at the Fed, which is, what, every single day? Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, so I hear you on that. I mean,
at a certain
I actually
point,
got into a fight with Elizabeth Warren during a public hearing when I was testifying about what we were doing with AIG and Ally Financial. And she was beating me up that we should have tried to extract a discount from AIG's counterparties on their CDS on CDOs, which your audience probably understands what I just meant in those acronyms.
Sort of counterproductive if you want to reliquify the system and encourage some counterparty
But you faith. Had the power, she said. You had the power to get Goldman Sachs to give up a discount rather than to pay them off in full. Wasn't this a backdoor bailout of Goldman Sachs? And I was like,
no,
okay,
they were
Secretary, yeah, but she wasn't Secretary then. I was, you know, Professor Warren. So you tell me how I'm supposed to, as a governor of the United States, how I'm supposed to play that hand. I'm supposed to benefit AIG's shareholders by taking it out of Goldman Sachs, when in fact we're standing behind both of these companies. The whole point was to avoid defaults across the system and to avoid AIG defaulting on any of its obligations, because if it defaulted on any of its obligations, its credit rating would have been impaired and we would have been had to write even bigger checks.
What was the response to that?
A political response, right?
but meanwhile, there was no good solution. There was just what was the least bad solution.
And yes,
ultimately, even though we've recovered, there's been a cost to this recovery.
Oh, for sure.
Between income inequality and the rise of populism, and you know, it's one of those things that. It could have been a whole lot worse, but part of me feels like it could have been a lot better.
Yeah, I think the big mistake politically was the stimulus. Right? If you look at the Chinese,
too small.
The yeah. Chinese, you know, and if you look at what the federal government's doing now, right? These Republicans who were totally opposed to the Obama stimulus have just enacted, you know, one of the largest
$1 trillion at way higher in the economic cycle as opposed to. And by the way, for those of you who don't like that comment about a Republican controlled Congress affecting a giant stimulus, be sure and send your emails to Jim Milstein at yahoo.com.
Yeah.
It's true, you know, Keynes had this right. In the middle of a financial crisis, you cut taxes, you deficit spend, and when you have a robust economy, that's when you can stop your deficit spending and raise taxes and balance the budget. We've done it totally ass backwards.
Right, and so, you know, in the 2009, we got Democratic-controlled Congress to do a stimulus, but Obama went back to the well in 2010 after the Tea Party took the Republican Congress. In 11, just couldn't get it done. Went back with an infrastructure program, could never get anything through the Republican
Congress. Well, McConnell specifically said, my role is to make sure he gets nothing else done going forward.
Right. So for, you know, so we you reap what you sow. Here we are.
I guess we do. So I have a million other questions, but I want to get to our favorite questions before. So let's jump right into this. What's the most important thing that people don't know about Jim Milstein?
God. I'm a horrible golfer.
Really?
Yeah.
Me too, but I don't play golf.
So okay, well, there
what's
you
your
go.
Excuse?
I don't know. I'm a glutton for punishment.
Really? Yeah. But you play regularly?
No, I try. I can't play regularly, but I try.
That's very funny. Tell us about your early mentors.
I had a professor at Princeton, a guy named Sheldon Wolin, who recently passed, who is a political theorist and a historian of political theory. And you know, and that's what I did my first years as an academic. So he had a very important influence on my intellectual development. As a career, I had a partner at Cleary Gottlieb named Alan Applebaum, who really taught me how to be a lawyer. Taught me the whole how to deal with clients, how to analyze a situation, how to take multi-parties with conflicting interests and produce a common result that was acceptable to them.
And, you know, we haven't even discussed your dad, who is a renowned attorney. How did he impact your career decision? Did you know you were always going to be a lawyer?
No, it was like a residency requirement in my family.
I kind of had the same thing.
He, you know, my father loves. He's still alive and still, you know, practicing here and there.
Your dad's 90, though, isn't
92
he?
92 this year.
Still practicing.
Still practicing. Still
God
giving
bless
advice.
Him. Oh, my
still
God.
Still giving advice to people. He's consulted. And the thing is, he loved, when I was growing up, he just loved what he did, right? So, I mean, it was hard, you know, to look at him and be with him and not see the law as something that was incredibly engaging. And because it, and for him it was, and as has been for me, a mix of, you know, a crossing between private sector and public sector.
Right.
I mean, the law, the rule of law is what governs our private relations, but someone has to create that. Yeah. Somebody has to create that law.
Right.
And that's a public policy exercise.
So what, maybe this is a good point to ask this question, what attorneys and other professionals have influenced the way you approach both legal banking and public service?
You know, there's been lots of influences on that. But I mean, I think the important point here is that I have found that there's really no upside to dishonesty. And that, you know, people who can't be trusted are people who are not going to get stuff done except in dark rooms and back alleys. And so if you want to work in the social, political, legal, business world, you know, your reputation is the most important thing you have, and observance of ethics and honesty. I know this is a counterfactual in this administration, but the observance of ethics and honesty is extremely important to your long-term success.
I'm looking for a response to that, and the only thing I could come up with is, it's funny how each subsequent administration's popularity gets revisited in the future. Not only has George Bush's reputation gone up during this administration, but the Obama administration's ratings have all gone up, especially because, you know, drama-free, no scandals. The key word that keeps coming up is integrity, and hopefully that will matter again at one point in our future.
Yes, I'm sure it will.
You mentioned a couple of books. Tell us what your favorite books are. What do you read for fun, fiction, nonfiction?
I'm a nonfiction reader. And, you know, again, after having gone through a major historical event and had a ringside seat, I've been reading lots around it. But I think the most interesting nonfiction book I've read, unrelated to the financial crisis, is a book called Sapiens.
I knew you were going to go that way.
And by Harari. And I think it's an extremely important book.
You seen the follow-up?
I haven't read the follow-up. He's gotten more
Homo
pessimistic.
Deus. Yeah. It's much darker.
Yeah, much more
this
dark.
This book is very interesting. Yeah. I don't agree with everything in it.
Yeah.
But at least there's some recognition that humanity is special. And Homo Deus is like, all right, now here's how everything goes to hell in the future.
But I think the fundamental insight of Sapiens is really important, which is, you know, the success of the species has been our ability to collaborate around abstract concepts. Our communication is obviously key, the development of language and all of that, but mm-hmm. then the ability to collaborate and coordinate our behavior around abstract concepts, concepts of God, concepts of nation, of state, of community. I mean, these are all abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
You can't visualize the nation except through symbols and through, a summary of its history and a set of objectives that you might believe are important to it to achieve in the future. To me, that's the big challenge that the country faces, is an ability, again, to figure out how to collaborate together on a common future. Across this very diverse country.
Quite interesting. What are you excited about right now? What do you think is a fascinating issue or topic these days?
You know, with the New York Giants having gone 1-4 to start this season, I'm just so depressed. It's very hard to focus on anything other than that for the moment. I'm still licking my wounds.
So let's talk about a time you failed and what you learned from that experience.
I was in, as a young lawyer, not so young, I was handling my first major cross-border restructuring, and the creditors were represented by one of the greats of the bankruptcy bar, Leonard Rosen at Wachtell, Rosen, Lipton, and Katz.
Sure, he's the Rosen and Wachtell.
Yeah, and he was just a gentleman and a scholar and a wonderful person. And we were having a dialogue as to how we were going to land this company in a restructuring, he representing the creditors, me representing the debtors. And we had, as you can only have with Leonard, a kind of gentlemanly disagreement with regard to sort of what the end game was, who was going to end up owning the company and how we were going to restructure it. And we were resisting putting the company in front of a judge too soon until we had an agreement with the creditors, because most bankruptcies are less expensive and less time consuming.
If it's
pre-packed, right? The judge is there to confirm what everyone's agreed rather than to mediate the dispute ongoing.
Right.
And so we were resisting filing it. And Leonard thought that, you know, we were being irrational and impudent. And so he did something that I didn't believe could be done. He filed an involuntary petition. The creditors put the company into bankruptcy in Canada. And under Canadian law, I had been advised by my Canadian co-counsel, this was not a procedure available to creditors. And so Leonard picked up the phone. So he called me one morning. He said, I think you need to be in Toronto this afternoon. And I said, why? He said, because we have put the company into a CCAA proceeding in the Ontario Superior Courts this morning. And I said, you can't do that. He said, well
we did.
We just did. And so
whoops.
You know, the lesson, the failure was a failure of imagination, failure to realize that the law is not a given, but something that is created and constantly created every day.
A little more flexible than you imagine.
Exactly.
That's quite interesting. So what do you do for fun other than be a terrible golfer?
So I hike. I've got a group of friends that we've gone on various, you know, trips around the world, you know, hiking and exhausting ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the, you know.
Any place interesting recently?
We went to Norway last last year or the year before.
And we were discussing Norway last night. That's amazing.
Up and down the fjord country. It was gorgeous.
Really?
The food was spectacular. And we had a stopover on the way to the hike in Oslo and on the back, coming back in Stockholm. And Stockholm is just an amazing city.
Really?
An amazing city. And
I've
these
never
two
been.
Countries, and these two countries actually really. For Americans,
mm-hmm.
And particularly, you know, given our current dispute about the role of government,
right,
and inequality, a trip to these countries should be mandatory because they have national health care,
mm-hmm.
they have subsidized higher education, they have
retirement,
they have affordable housing mm-hmm. subsidies.
Maternity leave, paternity leave.
All of that, all of those basic social system supports, and yet they're dynamic economies with entrepreneurship and growth mm-hmm. rates that rival ours. Now, they're small, homogeneous countries. They don't have the many of the challenges we have in establishing commonality. But
mm-hmm.
but these are, you know, what the right would call social welfare states that are functioning. Where the gap between the richest and the poorest is only 3 times, not the 300 times
wow.
it is in the United States. And yet they've maintained a sense of entrepreneurialism and dynamism in their economy. The nanny state is not necessarily, deterring dynamism and entrepreneurship in the economy.
Sounds fast. I've been to Helsinki. I've been to Copenhagen. I've never been to Stockholm. I assume you do that in the summer and not the winter.
Yes, exactly.
So if some young lawyer or recent college grad or millennial came to you and said they were thinking about a career in restructuring and that aspect of banking, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, it's a choice, just as we were talking about before, it's a choice between business school and law school. I'd say go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
Get firm grounding in the law. It's been a great career for me. I like being a problem solver.
Mm-hmm.
And, each of these restructurings is different, as I said before, but, in effect, you're taking something and making something out of a failure. And, and sometimes the something is just redeploying the capital and liberating the capital that's involved in a bad business. But most of the time, you're figuring out what went wrong and fixing it
mm-hmm.
And saving, capital and jobs and so you can kind of feel like you did something good.
Quite interesting. And our final question, what do you know about the world of corporate restructuring today that you wish you knew 25, 30 years ago when you were really first getting started?
Well, we talked a little bit about the deregulation of the financial system. I mean, the consequence of that is we went into the 1980s with a bank-centric financial system
mm-hmm.
where credit intermediation was primarily conducted by banks. We ended. We came out of the financial crisis after 40 years of deregulation with a market-centered funding system, and the development of the secondary markets and the secondary credit markets,
mm-hmm.
The shadow banking system, starting with the junk bonds created by Mike Milliken in the late mm-hmm. 80s. We have a bond market that now dominates credit intermediation. And the bond market has greater and greater transparency with secondary, with trades
mm-hmm.
all the time and prices. So there's the illusion of fair value created by, the day-to-day pricing of a given
right.
bond.
That
pricing may not hold. And it may reflect supply-demand dynamics rather than fundamental value. It may reflect, the interest rate policy of the Federal Reserve as compared to where it was when the bond was originally issued. There are lots of it, but market participants today who live by their marks and are judged by their marks and are measured by their marks and are compensated by their marks, that is the biggest difference, right? I used to sit in rooms in the 1980s with banks and insurance companies and talk about fundamental value, and the mark didn't matter. what they were trying to do is maximize the recovery of their position. Mm-hmm. And today you sit in a room with traders who are trying to maximize their liquidity and their mark. And very different from fundamental value.
Quite fascinating. We have been speaking with Jim Milstein. He is currently the co-chairman of Guggenheim Securities, an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law, and former chief restructuring officer at Treasury. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, Bloomberg.com, and you can see any of the other 225 such conversations we've had over the past 4+ years. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put together these conversations each week. Michael Batnick is my head of research. Medina Parwana is my producer. Taylor Riggs is our booker. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.